Hey everyone, I'm Andrew Coates. I am the host of the Live Free and Die Hard podcast. I'm here today with my friend and fellow Tunisian writer, Tom Morrison, based out of Northern Ireland. He's a strength and mobility coach, and he's recently seen his YouTube channel grow to 500,000 followers. We're going to ask Tom, and you're going to get a whole bunch of stuff, including whether YouTube subscribers or Instagram followers are more valuable, how to leverage your YouTube following, how media growth has changed Tom's life and career, how it's freed him up, what challenges he's run into, and a breakdown of some really important mobility concepts. This includes, but is far from limited to, the difference between active and passive mobility, how to intelligently program variety, and the value of getting published on notable publications versus building your own library of resources, and a whole lot more. Stay tuned. Tom, it's amazing to have you back, my friend. You're someone that I have just, I'm thrilled to see thriving. You know, you and I obviously both written for T-Nation for quite a while, and you've seen some really explosive growth. Your YouTube now is what, just shy of 500,000 followers, 300,000 followers on Instagram. That's wild. So I want to jump right in, and fun question. So are YouTube subscribers more valuable than Instagram subscribers? Not to like distill people down to like their quote economic value or anything like that. And we'll go from there.
I think like YouTube seems to have more of a informational based kind of following anyway, because people are there looking for things specifically. Instagram, you're more on it to be entertained or pick up, you know, a quick tip or something like that. So definitely I find the YouTube people will ask more in-depth questions and want to know way more about things that you've maybe talked about or whatever. So the comment management on it is much harder than Instagram. So Instagram is usually just like a quick haha or, you know, the odd little thing thrown in. So yeah, the kind of questions you get and messages and stuff from people from the two different platforms are quite different. But yeah, YouTube's the one probably we're most excited about building, because it's the one I think it's going to outlive everything pretty much.
All right, we can dance around all the stuff. So, you know, just off air, you were telling me that you've actually seen the growth, especially on YouTube, has been rather quick. And I think a lot of people, you know, in general, especially social media fitness coaches, would sort of crave the status of having a large following. And would you wish this kind of explosive growth of engaged following on just anyone? Like, obviously, what's changed in terms of being able to keep up with the engagement?
We have to have staff now, so there's a bigger like it is a full-time commitment, and it'd be totally impossible to do by myself. So there's three of us now that do managing of comments, and we've actually taken on someone else new that's going to be helping out with that stuff as well. So I'm sort of falling back more into just dealing with our like Facebook group and email and stuff like that. And I'll always want to keep up with comments and stuff anyway, but just general management of things day to day, it'd be impossible to keep on top of yourself. It's something that, so we've had the explosive growth, yes, over the couple of months, but like before that, we still did have a following we've been building for 7 years. So we're used to a high volume of questions and messages and stuff always coming in anyway. So that's just like 10x essentially. So the ability to, you know, comprehend it all and deal with the questions that you kind of get on a day-to-day basis was already built up, already there. If that was just, you know, say you just started 6 months ago and you were thrown into this, you wouldn't be able to cope. You'd just be, your mind would be blown. You wouldn't know what to do. And you have to realize that there's, you know, yes, you get loads of people telling you you're fantastic every day, but you also get loads of people wanting to disagree with you and hate on you every day as well. It's, you know, when you're at that scale, you see the weirdest amount of people come out of the woodworks and stuff as well. You know, everybody has their opinion on things, and some people are very passionate about trying to tear you down and stuff as well. So yeah, it's something, it's nice to have known how to deal with it before it exploded a lot. So it's it's a different beast completely, you know.
I've seen people, you know, over the years in the industry who grew large followings because they were very savvy at social media, and they were very good at perhaps riding a popular trend. So around 2017, infographics went wild. And some people, like, I always use the examples of Dr. Spencer Nadolsky, Sohee Lee, Jordan Syed, are three of the people. There were others who did really well, early adopters to that strategy. Spencer has a video tutorial on how to do Canva infographics on YouTube from forever ago, right?
Yeah. One
of the true pioneers. And Jordan Sy was, you know, taking the people he was mentoring and telling them to do it. But all three of those people, I would argue, had pretty strong foundations, brands, quite credible. They'd already built resources, right? So, and you look at them all now, and they're all very successful. They have lots of infrastructure. Whereas I saw people at that same time who blew up through, you know, infographics, which that trend, I think, plateaued off and died off quite hard because it became very generic, and it was hard to distinguish you as the person away from the memes.
Yeah. But
I watch other people grow large followings but fail to capitalize on it. I think I kind of rode the next wave, which was, I was an early adopter of this, of the Twitter style graphic. Now those are very generic and ubiquitous, and I find there's a lot of copycatting, but same thing. And now I think you really smashed on the video based stuff. You've seen, there's a bunch of people I know all over the UK. Steve Keane, who I once upon a time mentored, I will not take credit for what he's done, but he's blown up to over 800,000 Instagram followers in what seems like about maybe just over a year. Rachel Henley has blown up hundreds of thousands. There are several other examples of this, and they've ridden video. Video has got the most viral growth potential right now. And, you know, what would you say to someone who, again, seeks this growth, but hasn't built the either the habits or the infrastructure or the habits to create infrastructure of the business?
You really, so like, you can use other people for inspiration, but you've really got to get yourself into your own content, you know, and being very good at what you do is the number one thing. So you can't just expect to be able to come across well on video if you're not extremely good at what you do. So all of that, the in-person coaching and stuff, like way before I went online, just all those hours of explaining things in different ways and trying to simplify them and honing your craft. If you can start to get that element of your personality into your content, so the way that you would, if you're just sitting talking to a client, into your content, in your own amusing way or whatever, or even just the likes of Steve, like you're really just dry, witty comedy as well. You know, everybody gels with different people. So it's just really about getting comfortable being yourself on camera, because a lot of people do want to put on a persona and stuff like that. And, you know, even though I will come across in my own content as being this absolute lunatic, whenever you do get me excited about something, I will be bouncing around the room and like really expressive and stuff like that. So it is actually who I am. So it's just about trying to get that into your own stuff and not worrying about what anyone's going to think of you or whatever, because at the end of the day, some people are going to like you, some people aren't. That's just the way it is. So especially in terms of video, like just start making those videos and start trying to communicate yourself in the best way that you can, and helping people. And in the short form world, so it just depends. Some people are better at short form stuff, some people are better on podcasts and things like that. So just trying to have that wee mix and elements of stuff. So even, you know, taking clips, if you are a podcaster, taking those little clips out and starting to share those from your podcast. If you're talking about something interesting, there'll be a minute clip in there somewhere to start using that stuff. The stuff that really took off for us viral wise, like we have done lots of videos that were like high budget. We've done videos that were like, you know, loads of different scenes and, you know, making them loop and all this here kind of stuff. But the stuff that went really viral for us was just clips of me talking at seminars, teaching people. And like a good story for you, actually, well, the funniest thing was, it was just after COVID. It was our first seminar back after COVID, and only five people came to it. One of them worked for us. So five people came to this seminar, which I was devastated about. You know, I was like, you know, I wouldn't say that I have much of a big ego, but, you know, only having five people come to a seminar of mine, I was like heartbroken. I was like, this is unbelievable. Like, because we were used to having like 25, 30 people coming all the time. So it was just that like after COVID slump. But I says, right, bring the video camera. We may as well get some clips or something here out of this just while I'm teaching. So we just had the camera set up while I was doing stuff, and we started making little clips from that seminar. And it was one of those, was the first ones on TikTok to go viral. I got millions of views on it, and yeah, it exploded the TikTok. And then that same clip, then we tried on Facebook, we tried on Instagram, same thing happened. So it was the substance of the content and the way I was teaching that just really grabbed people, and it worked on multiple platforms. And then the same has happened on YouTube as well.
And you hit on something big there, the quality of the concept. So I will occasionally be asked to evaluate someone's social media, right? Like something that I'll do a little bit just out of fun, or, you know, consulted for it. And so I was analyzing a guy I know social media, and decent following, but very, very low engagement metrics. And of course, I'm looking mm-hmm. at this going, all right, like, are you buying followers? What's going on here? And he's like, no. And I go back in time, and sure enough, there's better engagement in the past. And what he was doing is he's pulling out, you know, I'm sure he was farming it out. Someone was taking a lot of clips from his podcast, and they were all sort of like him sitting there in the same frame. So, and there was a whole bunch of them on his wall, you know, in sequence. So they all look like the same thing. And ultimately, I think whoever was pulling them out, these are fairly generic takes. There wasn't like what you described, there's probably something I had, something kind of wow. There was humor, your energy, you know, you're anybody who's listening to the audio, and they got to go look you up. You know, you've got long hair, you got the glasses, you got the goatee, you've kind of got like this, almost like this Weird Al Yankovic sort of like thing and energy going on, right? People need to actually plug into that. They need to go check out your media. I promise, like, they'll get you, right? And it's part of this perfect ensemble. But I think if you just take these very generic takes and tease, like, farm like an entire podcast and get a whole bunch of them out of there, chances are you're going to get some what I'll call mediocre stuff. And if you spam mediocre stuff on the platform and people just kind of meh, and they're scrolling past it, you'll shadow ban yourself very quickly. And I think that's what happened. So I got him like, all right, stop doing this. The quality of the content actually has to be really good. Mix up your format a little bit so it doesn't look like you're just sharing the same reel over and over and over. And things started to improve. Okay, let's pivot a little bit, because I obviously have a million questions about YouTube and all that, and we can dance around. But I mean, your brand is mobility, right? You're the mobility guy. And you've been writing about that stuff for T Nation. You know, a lot of your media is about that. So can you explain a few important concepts? One that I love is the idea between active and passive mobility, passive range of motion. Why does this matter? And can someone have too much mobility?
Oh, yes, absolutely. My business partner, Jenny, she's hypermobile. So she's too flexible in all of her joints. So it just becomes this like, oh, it's great, look at all the things you can do, but it's like you get hurt all the time. And, you know, doing the most basic exercises, you know, even just like a single arm dumbbell press, you can dislocate your shoulder. So there's obviously something that you can have too much flexibility. So it's not this great thing. Oh, wow, look how flexible you are. It's like, if you've no control over that, it's just as bad as being really inflexible and not being able to do things as well. So active and passive, if you can passively achieve a lot of range of motion and you don't have the strength in it, that's just a recipe, you know, for injury. You'll obviously be able to go further if you sit in a deep stretch and you start breathing and stuff like that there. But if you then can't replicate any strength at all within that range of motion, then it's kind of like a, you know, what's the point kind of thing. You know, not everyone should train to be a contortionist. It's not a good idea. So you want to make sure that you've got a good level of strength. So the way I just shifted my coaching over the years was just to use full body joint movements that will increase your flexibility as you work on them, but also build strength at the same time. One of my favorite things in the world is the deep split squat, where you try and get the knee as far over the toe as you possibly can. So not the Bulgarian version. And if you start loading that up and doing it regularly, your ankle mobility is going to improve, your hip mobility is going to improve. You're going to start to get deeper into your squats. It's going to help your squat as well. So it's a nice, good thing to program, and it builds strength and stability and all at the same time as improving your flexibility. So there's, you know, loads of ways to do certain things. And like, if you enjoy yoga, for example, like, you know, by all means do yoga, but it's not the only way to do stuff. You can use progressively loaded strength movements to build strength and stability and flexibility all at the same time. And if you have a nice combo of resistance bands and, you know, stability based exercises, bodyweight exercises, even, you know, you're going to be able to hit a lot of things without boring yourself to tears as well. So a lot of the stuff that I do that improves, like, especially when people get our program, they're like, this feels like a workout. And it's like, well, yeah, it should do. Like, what do you want? You want to improve your mobility by sitting and doing nothing? Like, you need to work for it. If you want to improve your mobility, you have to work for it. So, you don't want to be too passively flexible. You want to have strength within your ranges.
I mean, it's all about being able to control your access into those ranges of motion, right?
Yeah.
Can you elaborate
on
that?
You want to have that you're able to switch on and do it straight away almost, so that you don't need an intensive 45-minute warm-up before you do anything. You want to be really in control of everything so that you can do a quick warm-up and just jump into your normal training. You know, you shouldn't have to stretch all of the time if you're doing good movements often enough.
Can you explain how the nervous system regulates most of this, its role?
How it regulates?
Yeah, like what is the nervous system's role in mobility and flexibility?
Oh, yes. So if your body deems something is not safe, it will shut you down. It will just put the brakes on and you won't be able to do something. So if you have really, really tight hips, for example, and you try and sit into a deep squat or whatever, and your brain's going, nah, something's not moving there, something's pinching, something doesn't feel good, you'll get signals of pain, or you just won't be able to achieve the range. Whereas if you break that down, and again, bring it back to a split squat, if you work on split squats one side at a time and show your hips, show your brain essentially, hey, look, I can do this on this side. And look, I can do it on this side as well. Why can't I do it on both sides? You'll actually see an instant improvement in someone's flexibility. Just, you can actually explain someone into better positions by showing them, look, you can do it fine on both sides when you do them individually. So let's put them together. So I've had people, I don't know if any of your followers know the overhead squat, where you squat with a barbell above your head with your arms locked out. So it's quite a challenging movement mobility wise. I've had people come to me unable to like even do a quarter squat with the bar above their head and wobbling around like mad. Taking them through a few exercises and within 15 minutes saying, right, let's try this again. And boom, down to the bottom of the squat with the bar above their head. Because it's just, if your brain perceives something as dangerous, it's not going to let you move in a certain way. And the best way to meet your nervous system is to set up box jumps and keep adding height until you get to a point where you try to jump and your legs don't let you. There's your nervous system right there. So it's all about finding ways to build confidence and show your body, show your brain that it's a safe thing to do. That's going to allow your body to actually move better. So yeah, the nervous system is a wonderful thing.
Another example of that is for, and a lot of us have had this experience, is we load up the bar, you know, heavy deadlift, one rep max. And you have your, everybody's had the experience of that kind of new one rep max. And it felt often enough, it actually kind of came up like fast. It's almost like I think of it as your nervous system has been primed up. You're amped up after warming up and going through everything to pull that. So you feel like, oh shit, I should easily be able to pull another like 5 pounds, put a 2.5 on the bar. And it's like giant magnets are holding that weight down. Now, there's probably some nervous system fatigue by the point you get to that. But I think it's just also the nervous system saying, no, this is dangerous. We're not doing this, right?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I really don't like training by myself. You know, I know a lot of people can, but if you can't like have an external stimulus to like take your mind off things and to, you know, amp you up, like if you're in a gym with your friends around you going, come on, or you've just seen your friend lift that weight, it is so encouraging for you. And it takes a lot of those things away. Whereas if you're standing by yourself, you're feeling a bit tired and, you know, you're looking at that bar and you're going, is that going to come up or not? And there's nothing around to distract you and you start getting in your own head. Your body's actually going to form less. It's not going to work the way you want it to. So yeah, it's all about just trying to trick the brain essentially into getting things going. It's why people use smelling salt as well. That brief second of going, what's going on, is enough to like get your own mind.
And I guess I'm not an expert in the subtle nuances of competitive powerlifting, but you know, when you're peaking someone for a meet, you know, the periodization of having someone perform at the top level of the Olympics, there's super compensation that can't be maintained long term. You're trying to time it so that way their nervous system is able to go past its normal limits. I suppose here's another thing too. That's a good way to explain it. Whenever we have someone who competes in something that involves strength, but within a weight class, one of the goals is to get stronger, but not actually gain any weight, or, you know, get to the kind of the top of that weight class. I'll leave weight cutting out of this equation for simplicity. But what you're ultimately doing is you're trying to get more out of your nervous system to be able to recruit the existing muscle fiber more intensely. And like you alluded to earlier about the body saying, nope, like I get injured. I think of it as a red line, excuse me. And so we don't want to live in that red line all of the time. You hear these stories about like old grandmas, you know, flipping cars off of children that are trapped under there. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's like the body and the nervous system basically will not let you fire all muscle fibers voluntarily at any given time, because if it does that, that's actually going to cause injury. It'll tear tendons. It'll just damage joints. Now, people don't talk about the fact that grandma is just, her body's wrecked after doing that to save the kid. But it's kind of like, I think the good example is when someone's drowning, you don't swim out to them because their adrenaline and everything is just firing at all cylinders, and they'll literally climb over you and you, both of you will drown if you do it. But in the case of the gym, what are we trying to do? We're actually trying to let ourselves be able to voluntarily access more of that red line. So that way we could express the most power, the most strength, the most performance, even if it's temporary. Can you take that even further?
It's just that exposure that you want to be pushing things over that redline, like you said, just every now and again within your programming and testing yourself so that you know that there's more there. So when you go back to the start of another program, that you have more in the tank and you know that you're able to keep on pushing that. So it, you always want to be pushing your boundaries with anything. And it's why I like people to learn like multiple things. So even if you are, say, just wanting to do powerlifting again, to bring it back to that, you're only doing three lifts all of the time. You want to be still working on your general athleticism as well, like challenging your brain to coordination exercises, things that make your brain have to think and fire in different ways, so that when you do run into something that would maybe cause you to have a compensation pattern or whatever with your body, it's better at figuring things out. The more you work on balance and coordination and those athletic attributes, your body gets smarter, essentially. So that's why, like, if you ever see, sometimes I'll share stuff about learning how to juggle while standing on one leg, all that kind of crazy stuff. It's really just so your body then, say, instead of you favoring one leg, if you've ever seen anyone doing a squat or a deadlift and they start pushing everything off the right leg or whatever, and twisting and going to the side and stuff, if you give yourself more things that your brain finds challenging and has to figure out, then you're going to find that those things start to figure themselves out and work themselves out, rather than you know, doing some kind of mad, crazy unilateral program where you do 15 and a half lunges on your left leg and 14.5 lunges on your right leg and stuff like that, and you're trying to figure all these things out. It's like, just get better balance and coordination stuff, and you'll find that you have a smarter body that's able to adapt to a lot more things.
How do you approach intelligently programming variety? Because I think we have two sort of disparate ends of the spectrum. One is the camp, and I tend to drift a little bit more in this direction, where we stay within a narrower range of tools, you know, focus on basic skills and progressively overload them, get really, really good at this sort of stuff over time, right? I think most coaches, most of the time, will stay within a narrower range, but then a lot of times get very rigid and say, oh, there's no value in having variability within your programming. I don't think that's true. And then you have the other people who are just doing like random, and we know the types, we see it on social media a lot, random nonsense, super ridiculous, overly complex, creative shit that A, is probably pointless. B, it's like, I'll throw some shade here, but I won't name any names. That you get somebody using two trap bars in a ridiculous way instead of just grabbing a couple of dumbbells. And then of course they're taking up two trap bars of someone else in the gym probably needed, doing something ridiculous. We'll leave it at that. Or one of my biggest pet peeves, I see sometimes there's this older lady, and her coach is always showing her doing stuff. Now, this older lady is amazing. Sweet God, she's strong. She's capable. She's amazing. But the stuff she's doing is dangerous. And I mean, I don't like using that language about much, but what I've seen is like, what we're seeing is the survivorship bias of this fact that this lady has probably not yet gotten hurt. Maybe we haven't seen anything, or maybe there are other clients who did get hurt doing these stunts. But these are silly circus stunts that actually have like very little training validity, and I think are very high risk. And we've got coaches putting this on social media for clout, right? They're absolutely just doing it for clout. So let's bring it back to the question. How do you intelligently program variety?
By using your warm-ups and your cooldowns effectively, essentially. So I always like to treat a warm-up and a cooldown of like, move your body like a body. So make sure you're taking your joints to the ranges, make sure you're doing stuff that your spine likes to do. And then within that 45-minute session in the middle, it's like, you know, lift or do the things you're training to do, the things you want to get good at, the things that are going to build muscle or build your conditioning, whatever it is. That's where, you know, you want to be pushing yourself. And then in the end, 15 minutes, that's where you bring it back to the, right, let's offset some of the stuff I did here. So if you were doing heavy lifting and it was just all isometric tension kind of stuff, no spine movement, grab a resistance band and do some twists with the band and actually, you know, pull in a little bit of weird variations and stuff just to loosen off the muscles. You'll find that you don't leave the gym feeling like a fridge freezer, and you're actually able to walk and move again, you know, and I find that more effective than sitting in passive stretches, essentially. So it's just about giving yourself enough of the stuff that a body wants to do. And then you're going to find that you're able to actually push yourself and you're training a lot more, you know, and especially, you know, even having things. So I really like movements that I can progressively load, but I still qualify as mobility movements. So weighted single leg deadlifts, I still qualify them as a mobility exercise, but it's still something I can progressively load and improve over time. And you're still going to get a training effect from it as well. So if you combine that alongside with your deadlifts as well, it's like, well, there you've got your stability and your balance element included with your heavy lifting, and you, the deadlifts you've done with the straight bar or whatever on both legs, you're pre-fatigued before you do them. So then there we go, another, you know, training element, and it's still mobility technically. So yeah, but so just adding in a bit of resistance band work and some exercises that have a large range of motion and have stability requirements. Like, it's awesome. It's enough balance. You don't need to get overly fancy with it. You know, there's a lot of really good movements, again, like that split squat I mentioned. If you start to load those up as well, you know, you're hitting a lot of things at once, which is, you know, that's what you want. You want the most effective things for your time.
And like single leg, especially, they're going to be within reason. There's limitations on loading. Chances are you're going to be gradually approaching this stuff. So you're going to get the canary in the coal mine of, okay, if something actually doesn't like this early on, you'll know before you probably put yourself in a position where you're really going to get yourself hurt, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, if you're wobbling all over the place when you're trying to do a single leg deadlift, it's like, let's not use the weight right now. Maybe let's try and practice some while holding on first, build that up. And, you know, and that's something to me that I'm like, you know, that's a big deal. If you can't do something that's, you know, should be a basic stability exercise, it's like you should probably focus on that for a bit.
I'm a big fan of what you just alluded to is adding external reference points, a little bit of stability. One of my favorite exercises is a supported single leg Romanian deadlift. One hand is holding on to, you know, maybe something that's 2.5 feet off the ground, like a bench. The other one's holding weight, and it gives you so much more stability. Now, one of the things there is you could actually really load these exercises. I like things like a supported Bulgarian squat where you've got the safety bar over your shoulders, and you're holding the safety spotter arms of the rack. You can really load the hell out of those things, right? And don't start there. You have to build up to this stuff. What about fear around loaded movement of your lumbar spine? Because Adam Meekins, I know, does wonderful stuff with this. He's a physio out of England, and he takes a lot of shit for a lot of the stuff he says. But I enjoy his stuff. I mean, he can get a bit irascible about it. I love him to death, but occasionally a little pedantic, sometimes pick some weird fights. But I like the underlying concept of the fact that we actually want to be able to bend and load at the spine. I don't think it's wise to do it maximally all of or much, if it ever. And I think a core brace is a really essential part if you're lifting super, super heavy. Thoughts? Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, you've got your optimal, you know, loading positions you want alignment for and all that there stuff. And yes, that's the stuff that you're gonna push and max out. But if you can't do something relative in some way with your back rounded as well, if you're not bringing that up to standard, then it's like you become one of those people that can, you know, deadlift 500 pounds, but you know, you tweak your back when you're putting your socks on. So you do want to have that balance of that, you know, like I have two disc injuries myself that still show up on an MRI today, even though I don't have any pain symptoms. And what I find is if I'm not doing rounded back stuff enough, if I'm not working on those things often enough, I'll have like the weird numbness sensation in my leg get worse and stuff like that. So it's so important to always be moving your spine the way it wants to move. So yes, it wants to know how to switch on and be rigid and strong for the likes of your lifting, but it also needs to move and twist and bend as well. And you do want to get stronger at that. You do want to actually start to add a bit of, you know, weight and, you know, have a bit of rounding in your back and stuff, but it's never, percentage wise, it's never going to be anywhere close to what you can do maximally in your lifts. But you don't want to have that you can't bend or twist at all. You know, if you're so weak doing that and you're so strong with the you know, aligned movements, it's just it's another margin for error essentially. So you want to be bringing them both up together. It doesn't make sense to only get good at making your spine be really, really rigid and not trying to strengthen it while through movement at the same time as well. So it's important to have that balance of the programming.
A few things there. One is a lot of coaches don't even realize this, but the lumbar spine is actually designed for flexion extension. Thoracic spine has more capacity for rotation. But here's something I'm really big on. I think Adam does this really well. It's trying to defeat this idea that people are fearful. I think if you're sensitized to fear and sensitized to expect pain when you do certain things, you're far more likely to experience that. So I don't like language that sometimes our industry gets caught up in that makes people fearful around doing various things, right? Oh, you shouldn't do this until a good example, it's common, and I'm not picking on anybody because like there's people I respect who say things I disagree with, but it's like, oh, you haven't earned the right to do a barbell squat until you've done, you know, X weighted goblet squats. I'm like, it's usually you haven't earned the right to load your squat. And a lot of people say this until you've mastered a bodyweight squat. And I think squat you might perpetuate this. I'm not necessarily a big fan of that rhetoric, because one of the things that cleans up and makes for an incredible looking squat. Like, is it put a dumbbell in their hands, goblet squat. It's this external reference that just seems to brace people and clean up their movement. Whereas a lot of people at a bodyweight squat, they look like a baby deer on ice, right? They're just so goofy. Give them this weight. Doesn't have to be like anything crazy. All of a sudden things tighten up. They take it seriously and they move great. That's one of my favorite teaching tools without throwing a lot of cues at them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I use weight to teach a bodyweight squat. So I would actually use the goblet squat and go with a lighter weight, see where they can get to, and say to them, right, see how everything feels right now. I'm going to really slowly take this dumbbell off you, and you need to maintain the tension you have everywhere, okay? And you'll do it, and you'll see them the first couple of times. Some people like start to fall backwards and like, oh, I can't hold the tension. But it's such a good teaching tool to help someone to get a bodyweight squat. So weight is, you know, an absolute fantastic tool to use. You know, anyone, you can, it's all, again, relative. There's like enough weights for everybody. So, you know, you can always use it as a teaching tool. You don't want to be trying to perfect a bodyweight movement, you know, and there's some people that are just stupidly rigid that can't sit comfortably in a bodyweight squat, but can, you know, squat and deadlift better than anybody else, you know. So it just depends on the person, really. Some people have a lovely just resting bodyweight squat that have never squatted before in their life. You ever meet those people that have no interest in exercise, and you see their squat and you're like, how is that possible? That is not fair, you know. So those people are always out there as well. So it always just depends who you're working on is the main thing.
Everybody listening, especially coaches, think about this. So I use the phrase external reference point. It's something I like. I definitely think this is something that, like, Dr. Pat Davidson talks about a lot. He really, really is big on this. And so when we're talking about holding that dumbbell in a goblet squat, it's not just weight. It's not just load. So we don't actually have to think about things entirely as just load. They can also be external reference. It is something that the body reacts to. It can, I mean, overloading and very, very heavy usually will go the other way, right? If you put a brand new person with a barbell overhead without, you know, appropriately building them up to that, that's probably going to add a dimension of difficulty. Whereas the goblet can actually make things easier, because what have we got? We've got an external reference point in hand. Oftentimes external reference points are going to be things that add stability. The goblet doesn't really, but oftentimes it just gives body segments something to interact with, which will actually just put them in the right place. So I like the concept of external reference. Sometimes we'll teach something by putting a band in someone's hand and then tugging on the band a little bit. What happens? Well, whatever joint we're kind of trying to stabilize suddenly engages a little bit, and they get into the right position, and then they move better. So I like this concept of external reference points.
Making someone's body have to figure out how to fix it itself is such a good thing. So having, like, using the band or whatever to pull it at someone's knee or whatever, instead of saying to them, you know, push your knees out, if you have something that's trying to push their knees in and they actively have to fight against it, it's just it's an easier way for people to learn. You know, if you help someone to figure something out themselves, you usually make a lot faster progress with them.
Okay, let's pivot into something I love talking about. And how important do you think it is for coaches, especially people who want to grow bigger brands, to get published on things like T-Nation, other notable publications? Or, I mean, this sort of false dichotomy, we'll get into this. Or do you think it's really important that they build, right, for their own websites, build their own YouTube libraries, build their own media, and drive people to that? Or do you think, how can they interact? You know, what do you think is important there for coaches?
Go for both. That's what I did. You know, you want to build your own brand up at the same time. But if you just go on to any, you know, website that you follow and you want to write for them, go and look at the way they want things. They'll usually have somewhere that says what they want it to be sent to them. Like, don't just send random emails. They'll want it in a certain format and stuff. So figure that out first and send something through. And my biggest tip for that, like, the first thing that you send, don't try and show how smart you are. Don't try and make the fanciest thing you ever have in the world. Make it relatable and that a normal person could read it. So someone that is just, like, only started training or something like that, and it's just really easy to digest, and it's just good quality information presented in a nice way. Do it that way rather than, like I said, trying to be as smart as you can. That was the first time I wrote for T-Nation. I'd sent in the three best movements for this, and it was, like, really in-depth and all this here stuff. And it was Chris, I think, messaged back.
Yeah, Chris,
he said no. I was like, oh, but we like this bit. I was like, okay. And so I reworked that one bit and sent that back in. And yes, and then that's when I, you know, then after that, there was never a no again after that kind of thing. So it's just sort of knowing, you know, what they kind of want. And, you know, it's you need to think about their audience. you know, don't just write stuff for coaches unless it's a website that does stuff for coaches. So yeah, that's the kind of stuff you want to think about. You know, what, who's the viewer that's going to be seeing this thing? That's who you're writing for. You're not writing for the magazine itself or the website itself. So you've got to think about who their readers are, and come at it that way. And that's going to help you to build your brand as well. So people are then going to search your channels if they like what they've seen. So that's going to help you to come up. It used to be like years ago, whenever Facebook, whenever Teen Nation published a video 4 years ago, they used to tag your page in the video post. And that used to be anytime one of my videos got shared there, like I must have got 200 followers that day just from people clicking on from there. But now the way everything changed, they want just the web, they go to their website now. And so yeah, that was the heydays. So there was actually a year I took off writing for any magazines, and then that's when that kind of got taken away, and I was like, oh, I really wish I had actually kept writing for that year to milk that as much as I could at the time. But it was more just focused on building my own stuff. So yeah, it's kind of tricky, especially because back then it was just me and Jenny back then, so we didn't have as much bandwidth to do stuff all the time. So there was that kind of like, oh, we're gonna have to not do any writing for Teen Nation and stuff for a while because we're trying to build this up instead. So yeah, it's you try and do as much as you can, but remember that you've only got as much as you can do, so it has to be really effective what you do pick to do.
I've noticed over time, because I've been reading Teen Nation for my entire career, there's a lot of people who wrote for it for a while, as certainly as they were emerging, and then they all started to build their own media and business and everything, and then they wrote for Teen Nation less and less. There are some people who've continued to serve Teen Nation, Eric Bach, Lee Boyce are a couple of good examples, who just continue, who've been there a long time, who continue to feed them stuff. But a lot of the old school group, like, you know, your Tony Gentilcore, I brought Tony back in and did something with him, you know, a year ago, which is really fun. Tony's also busy raising his little boy, right? But there's, let me get myself back on track here. I think there can be a tremendous amount of brand credibility for writing for these publications. I always saw it that way. And for the amount that I've been able to leverage the different things I've written for, I've written a lot for Teen Nation, but some of the other ones I've, Our Band, wonderful. I've written for them once. I love them as a brand. I think they're great. I wrote one piece for Kabuki Strength, although I'll be part of Kabuki Education Week for the third year in a row. So I actually do a fair bit of stuff for Kabuki. I think that's kind of high leverage. But I really enjoy being able to do these things for these different publications. One of the things I've done is I've used that. You know, it's always in my bio on Instagram. I share all the resources and people notice this stuff. And I really do believe it sets you apart in terms of credibility and authority in the industry, away from the people who are only just doing clever videos on social media, or, you know, writing witty things with their Instagram, right? And I think those things can be potent. I think you can build massive audiences. But I do like the fact that, you know, I tend to look at the people who, you know, a lot of those legacy Teen Nation people, your Ben Brunos or Tony Gentilcores or Cressy's, and I hold them in a different regard than I do someone who's just savvy with social media. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm totally the same. So you're going to have way more weight as a coach if you do write for respected, you know, publishers. You know, it's just a sensible thing to do. And like you said, you know, if you're just making entertaining videos online, you're just a clown. It's like, who's really going to want to buy your coaching program, you know, or who's want, you know, going to want to be a client of yours? So you've got to think about, you know, your overall credibility as well. So I can be a clown, but I can also back it up with, I've done this, and this, and help this much people and all that their kind of stuff as well. So, you know, that gives me the freedom to be silly and funny and stuff as well, because I know that someone then that looks into me a bit more is going to see I'm published here, there, and everywhere. And, you know, done all these things and stuff as well. So it is really important. You've got to think about that you're not, you know, people look into you a lot more than you think they do, and before they'll actually choose to work with you, for example.
I think there does come a point where if you have the bandwidth, you can continue to serve the publications, but I think it becomes, especially if, you know, brand and following grows a fair bit and you're trying to build the scale of business, right, for the end game, it becomes higher leverage. If you have the time to write one article, that article goes on your website and serves your email list and brings people back to your website and email list versus having it on most publications. You know, building a YouTube, for example, like the time it took you to build and invest that YouTube, yes, you are on someone's platform. Theoretically, like people will say, oh, only your email list is your own. But I tend to see a YouTube, a as long as you're not doing really stupid shit that's going to get you kicked off the platform, YouTube's probably safe enough where I would say you kind of own your audience in a sense. And therefore, so let's go back to this. What have you done, or how effective has YouTube been to drive your audience into your products, your coaching, your resources?
Well, all of our content is essentially, here, do you have this problem? Here's something that's going to help you to make progress with it. And if you can give someone that little bit of help, they're going to have way more trust in you. And then that's where they're going to message or comment or email or whatever to find out more, because they're like, oh, hey, this thing I've struggled with, this has helped. I want more. You know, if you can give someone that little bit of something, you know, this is the realization moment of like, hey, I haven't done that before. This is great. This is really helping me. It's such a powerful thing. And like I say, YouTube is definitely the one, I would say, revenue wise, that we've noticed the biggest increase from following in that. So Instagram took off quite quickly, but there was a bit of, you know, revenue increase from that. But whenever the YouTube really exploded, that was in terms of program sales, not the money that you get from YouTube itself, that went up as well. So our organic stuff started to meet what our like paid ad stuff would meet for free, essentially, which is just mind blowing, you know? So YouTube is definitely the one that you want to focus and grow on. I think people will be more likely to become a customer from YouTube than they are so much on the social media platforms themselves, you know, like Facebook and Instagram and everything.
I think you have a much deeper opportunity to create a relationship with people. I had my pal Funk Roberts on not too long ago, and Funk is, you're different, but you both have high energy. And I think that's a big thing. It translates through video really well. And Funk's got 700,000 YouTube subscribers, and he is crushing with business. He's a little older, been doing it a little longer than a lot of people, but he's really just doubled down into that space. And he's got Instagram, he's got a bit of a following, but he doesn't even really like care much about it. Everything is full send on YouTube. And I don't think he's really worried about, you know, trying to get published in various other places. He's just dominating on this channel. And like, I think a lot of coaches, I am bullish on social media. I think it can be really, really good. But I think a lot of coaches can be a little too caught up in the fact that social media, in terms of the time you spend in it, can be kind of low leverage. I think the individual touch points with people, if they're asking you questions, DMs, very, very high leverage. But I'm a big believer in, all right, you got to build these resources. I haven't done all of this very well. I mean, I've had the podcast for forever. And, you know, I've written a lot of articles, but I keep serving these other publications. But now it's like, all right, I got to get back around to feeding more stuff into my website and building this side of things. I'm just terrible at spreading myself too thin, try to do too much stuff. And I get pulled off in a lot of public speaking, which is time consuming and high leverage in some aspects and low leverage in others. But, you know, you can't do it all. I'm also a one man show, whereas you were smart and actually hired some people. So here's one. Have you changed since you've seen the growth of your business and your media?
Yes, I don't care about numbers as much anymore. As weird as it sounds, like, it's, you start hitting these crazy numbers and you can't even fathom the percentages that you're seeing of stuff. And you're just like, oh, I've still to get up and get the kids breakfast in the morning. There's nothing special. It's, you know, it's just another thing to me now. So, yeah, I used to think like, oh, I was like, well, whenever we had 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, I'll be the boy. Oh, I'll be so cool. And then we hit it and it was like, oh, you know, nothing changes. You know, it's just exactly the same. You still have to keep making videos and keep posting content and keep, you know, just keep working hard, you know, essentially. So yeah, a bigger following, it is definitely worth building, but you've still got to have the structures around that. So us with our free content, it's like, we're trying to inspire people to start moving and, you know, to actually take control of their mobility and stuff. But we need to make sure that we're then getting them on our email list and stuff and, you know, pushing them on from there essentially as well. So yeah, you don't just want followers for the sake of followers. You want to have an exceptional product, something to sell as well, so that you're building it for a reason, so that you can actually, you know, in monetary terms, like, actually make money as you're building your following as well. You don't just want to be like, oh, when I get 500,000 followers, then I'll release a program and I'll be great. It's like, no, you need to make money now. You need to have something to actually serve people that are coming in, you know.
Has the growth in the team freed you in any way, in any meaningful way? Are you able to direct more of your time, thoughts, energy to anything, stuff that matters, aspects of the business, big picture thinking?
Yeah, the big thing that we're going for this next year is to try and get us all working on a 4-day work week and actually reduce our hours and stuff so that we do have more time for life stuff. So we're out of that kind of like growth phase of like, and everything isn't working. We're out of that now, which is quite nice. So I essentially only do the things that I enjoy doing now. So I like coming up with content ideas. I like to study and try and explain things in certain ways. And I like to be on camera. I don't like video editing or any of that stuff. So I don't do any of that stuff. And yeah, any of the boring stuff, essentially, any admin stuff, I don't do anymore. So I just do the fun stuff, which if I enjoy doing it, that gives me more energy, which makes me more productive, which then everyone else will feed off that then, So if I'm enjoying what I'm doing, generally everybody else is going to be in a, having a better time as well. So yeah, it almost sounds quite selfish in a weird way, but it's like, no, I don't want to do any of the things that make me go ugh anymore. So I just only do stuff that I enjoy. And, luckily making videos and writing is a big part of that. So it's given me more time to have a bigger output. So like we have a new Instagram video that's able to be released like every day at the moment and stuff. And we've been able to do a short video on YouTube every day since last February. We're just able to pump out content at such a high, rate because there's 7 of us now, which is awesome.
Well, you answered my next question, is that do you still do it because you love it? That radiates
Oh yeah.
through your
That's
last
the
answer.
thing. Like, you get to ask that question, if money was not a thing, what would you still be doing what you're doing now? Absolutely, yes, I would. I love helping people and trying to make the best consumable information in the best way possible because it made such a difference to my life as a person when I started to meet teachers that I was like, hey, you've made this actually enjoyable. I like fitness now because you're a cool person. Like, I want to be that for other people as well. I want people going, nah, I had no interest in that for them actually to go, what, hang on, what do you say? What, I think I'll give that a go. I want to be that guy because I know how much of an impact it had on my life. So, I just want to spread that as much as possible. So, yeah, everything that we can do to invest into helping us to reach more people, to help more people, that's what I'm all about. So, yeah, even if we were making multi-millions every day, I'd still be doing the exact same thing. Wouldn't change at all.
This is incredible. Obviously, I think anybody listening could hear how much your passion for this radiates. You've been incredibly successful. I love it. I love seeing people thrive, right? They're absolutely abundant through that. We all do well when we have people in our community who are great people being successful. So with that, where can people dig in your resources?
TomMorrison.uk, or you can just go on the old Googles, just type in Tom Morrison. I'll pop up somewhere, probably with my top off, I think is actually one of the pictures that comes up. Tom Morrison, just search that. It's on in Tom Morrison Training on Instagram. TomMorrison.uk is our website, and just Tom Morrison on YouTube, Tom Morrison on Facebook. Just search that and you'll get lots of different stuff. And yeah, if you want to sign up to our email list, it's the 7 Days of Awesome. You can get that on our website. It's a free series that you can work on, and you'll kind of see. So anyone that's in the kind of business side of things as well, you kind of see our process of how we build trust and show people things. And then on day 8 of the 7 Days of Awesome, that's when we say, hey, we have a program as well. So it's a nice way to do things. You want to always be helpful and always be useful. And if someone then decides to sign up with you after that, that's great. But if not, and you've just been useful and helpful to them and they decide not to work with you, that's also great as well. So yeah, it's all just about spreading the message. And if you're so passionate about what you do, how could you not get excited about making content and wanting to share it and, get others involved as well?
Anybody who is really interested in YouTube, even if they're probably, who knows, maybe they will because they'll see value in the way you do it. But even if they're not necessarily interested in your programs, just go check out your YouTube to see what you're doing well on YouTube. You can learn a lot from people who are successful with media if you want to grow that media, if you want to learn more about video-based stuff or Instagram. Again, Tom, you've been exploding. It's really cool to see. Everybody listening, thank you. I have been endeavoring. I'm in the process of subtly, or maybe not so subtly, kind of shifting some of the ways I'm approaching this. I think the essence of the podcast will be really much the same. I think coaches will love it. I want to make this podcast more accessible to the everyday person as well. So I want to get into themes that are a little bit broader, and tap into all of the wisdom of my guests. If you enjoyed this one, you can help me expand the reach of this podcast by sharing it with a coach who you think would love it, what I've been doing. Or even someone in your world who isn't necessarily within the fitness industry who might get a lot of value out of this and from learning from my guests. I have more great guests I am in the process of getting back to being really consistent again. I know I had that little hiatus and I apologize for it, but I really am reinvigorated. I had to take a couple of months just after all the travel this year and some injuries, just feeling run the hell down. And we're sometimes terrible at that in our industry. All right. Tom knows that. So I've been working on just recuperating and I feel rejuvenated. So I hope you'll stay with me on this. I hope you'll stick around for the next episode. Tom, you're wonderful. I truly appreciate you. Thank you, my friend.